This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Vince Warren from the Center for Constitutional Rights joins us to talk about his recent trip to Palestine.
He knew it'd be shocking, but he tells us he really wasn't quite prepared for what he saw.
Retired Judge Advocate General Todd Pierce joins us to talk about American militarism.
The rule of law in the United States has degenerated. Attorney Pierce will explain why.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Catherine Franke. I'm a law professor at Columbia Law School, and I chair the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Attorney Vince Warren is the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's just returned from a delegation with human rights leaders to the West Bank and to Israel, where he was accompanied by CCR legal director Bahar Azmi and CCR deputy legal director Maria LaHood. We will speak with Vince about what they saw, with whom they met, and the current activities of CCR in support of Palestinian people, their sovereignty rights, and their human rights in the West Bank, in the occupied territories, and in Israel itself. Vince Warren is a graduate of Rutgers Law School, where he was a student of CCR founder Arthur Kanoy. Vince served on the board of the CCR before he became its executive director and was previously working at the ACLU.
Vince Warren, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
You've just returned from your first trip to the West Bank. Most people report being changed by that experience and by seeing the occupation up close. Is that the case with you?
Oh, it's exactly the case. I heard from a number of people who had been to the region before that it was going to completely change my life, and I knew at some level that that was true. But being there, for me, was like being dropped into an enormous state machine where every aspect of the machinery was designed and operates right now to completely repress the indigenous population. I've spent a lot of time on Native American reservations, but not in 1836, and it feels to me like how it would have felt during sort of the active U.S. government intervention and repression of Native American people, not just the detritus that we have now, but actually being in the middle of it. I've practiced for almost 25 years, and I've really come back a changed person, thinking about what this means for justice, what it means for lawyers, what it means for organizing, and what it means for the U.S. role that it plays in this type of machine.
Maybe you could give us some examples of what that apparatus looked like, of what you saw on the ground.
Well, the first thing that we did on this, it was a delegation that we went with a number of lawyers. And one of the first stops that we made was with a group called Grassroots Al-Quds, which is a grassroots organization that operates in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem. And the orientation that they gave us was the map. And so the first thing that they did was they showed us the tourist map and showed us how East Jerusalem was off of it. And then they showed us the UN map and showed us how it didn't capture what was really happening in East Jerusalem. And then they have a crowdsource map that they've used with groups. And the mapping was the orientation that I think was necessary to begin to understand, at least legally, how things operate in that region, how things are different in East Jerusalem than they are in the West Bank, than they are in Gaza. It was just extraordinary.
East Jerusalem was captured by the Israelis in 1967, and they're still holding on to it. And that's an Arab enclave that the Israelis would like to ethnically cleanse.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And you can begin to see how the strategies for what happens. And so the first thing that we learned, and this was true whether we were in the Naqab or we were in the West Bank or in East Jerusalem, we learned that the goal is to drive Palestinians out of the territories, out of the places where they call their homes, and to essentially move in people that are Israeli Jewish settlers and things like that. And frankly, I thought, when I was thinking about settlements, I thought that there were going to be these double-wide trailers that were somewhat informal. And in some regions, they are. But these were great shining cities that had not just magically plopped in the middle of Palestinian territory, but they, I think, metaphorically have raised, R-A-Z-E-D, the people, and actually raised the land and knocked down buildings to make way for these enormous, enormous settlements with swimming pools, whereas the indigenous Palestinian population, I shouldn't even call them indigenous because a lot of them are internally displaced people, that where they were living in some places in real squander with no access to water, with electricity, to those types of things. So it really does speak to the ethnic cleansing project that's actually happening here.
Now, your delegation visited Hebron as well, which is, to me, when I've been in the West Bank, one of the most difficult places where the IDF, the Israeli forces, and the local people are in conflict constantly. What was your impression of Hebron?
The day that we went to Hebron, well, actually 2 days before we went to Hebron, I got one of those State Department alerts on my phone. It said, U.S. citizens are warned not to travel to this region. There were warnings for Israeli citizens traveling to the region. Of course, we went anyway. And what we found was a couple of things. Number one, that there is a tremendous amount of tension that's happening in the region. But the way that the media and even the State Department portrays it for travelers makes it seem like it's a hyper-dangerous situation that no one, even in their right mind, should even go to observe. And that's actually not the case, that Hebron has to be observed in order to be believed. We went and met with a grassroots group called Youth Against Settlements in the area. Wonderful, wonderful guys. And the overarching feeling that I had was the settlers, these Israeli youth, and these were teenagers, largely walking around. They walked around like they owned the place. And the Palestinian, our Palestinian guides and escorts and comrades, there were places where they simply could not go with us. There was one point where we're going to be walking through a main corridor of closed shops to the Palestinian section, but the Palestinian guides had to walk through the cemetery to get there because they weren't allowed to walk on the same street. And we offered to walk with them, but they said, no, you have to see this for yourself. And when we went walking along the street, we were faced with these young kids that are carrying these semi-automatic weapons. And it's not just the weapons that are problematic, although I think weapons are problematic per se. It was the sense of entitlement and ownership over that strip of land that these young people had, which was galling to me. And it reminded me of when I was growing up here in New York, how I felt walking the streets of Bensonhurst back in the 1980s. It was a place where black people did not belong and white folks would come out with baseball bats. And it didn't feel like that was my part of the city. And it felt like I was wise not to be there. It was the same type of feeling. Here I am 50 years later, feeling that same feeling of fear and intrepidation. Fear and trepidation, because the city was just owned by these hooligans with guns.
How many are we talking about? Like, are there just a few sprinkled around, or do you feel like if your colleagues had gone with you, they would have immediately been surrounded and...
Oh, there is no opportunity for our colleagues to have gone with us. There were a couple of things that were at play. Number one, where we met, it was on this beautiful little field that was in the Palestinian section, and our host had a home. His home was declared a closed military zone. His house was declared a closed military zone. And he told us a story about how 2 weeks earlier, a couple of international journalists had come to interview him outside of his house to talk about the situation, and they talked about it. He went inside to go to the bathroom. They, being polite, went into the house as well, and all three of them were arrested by the Israeli military, which had been waiting outside. And so when I was trying to discern the line from where we were standing, which was about 25 feet away from the house. Where does that closed military zone? If I stick my toe across, where would I get arrested? It was impossible to discern. You know, he was saying, don't you see it? It's right here. There was no line. And so when we were meeting with them, And there were about 15 of us sitting outside. There were three IDF young military guys that were standing about 30 to 40 feet away just watching us. And so we went up and asked them what this was about. And they said, oh, we're just hanging out here. And our host was like, yeah, they know that there are international observers are here and they're checking to see what's going to happen. Just real quickly, while we were having that discussion, three, I would say, 12 or 13-year-old boys came strolling through the countryside. So while there was all this tension around the military and our hosts and us, these three kids walked through it like there was nothing there. And the military, when they saw the three kids, basically went to surround them to make sure that us international lawyers weren't going to be hurting these pre-adolescent kids. I mean, it was crazy. So that, you know, you have grown people that are trying to have a conversation, and it gets disrupted by the state forces that are trying to protect a population that, at least in that context, needed no protection whatsoever. And in fact, they needed to respect the fact that they were on other people's property.
Well, who else did you meet with, and what kind of discussions did you have with them about what Palestine Solidarity activists could do to support what they're doing?
We met with a range of groups. We met with B'Tselem, which is a legal organization that does work on behalf of Palestinians that live in Israel. And we met with Al-Haq, which is another human rights organization that works on behalf of Palestinians. And we met with a range of activist groups and legal groups. The thing that became really clear to me was how all of the advocacy strategies and the litigation strategies had been, at least on the ground, had been designed to push back against encroachment by the state of Israel in a number of different ways. So in terms of people's houses and their right to be safe in their homes, no one felt safe in their homes. Everybody talked about the police or the military coming in at 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning and just snatching kids.
Snatching
kids. They would go into the house and they would take kids. They would actually, what they would do is they would make everybody go outside of the house. They would go in at gunpoint. They'd knock the door down. They would separate and isolate folks looking for a particular person. Sometimes it's the father, sometimes it's the son, sometimes it's the daughter, based on quote unquote investigatory methodologies. So they say, well, this person is accused of throwing a rock or committing some sort of a crime. In the West Bank, in those contexts, all Palestinians are subject to military law, Israeli military law, whereas the settlers are subject to Israeli civil law. And what that means is, if you're a settler and you throw a rock, if you get arrested to begin with, you'll be arrested and you go to court. And if you're a juvenile, you'll have the protections of juveniles and you go through a court system. If you're Palestinian and you throw that rock, the first thing people tell me is that you run the risk of getting shot. That's the first piece that they do. The second piece is if they don't shoot you, then they'll immediately arrest you and put you in something that's called administrative detention, or they'll come in the middle of the night. And what administrative detention is, we're beginning to see shades of this here in the United States, is where you're not charged with a crime, but you're allowed to be held for extended periods of time, 4 months, going into 8 months, just for being under suspicion for doing something. So even if they technically don't have a suspicion, but they want to destabilize movements or they want to attack folks, they'll just come and snatch you, and that's what I mean. And these kids and young people are put in administrative detention. We actually went to the Ofer Detention Center, which where a lot of these young folks are taken, and it was actually heartbreaking. First of all, it reminded Bahar Azmi, our legal director who was there with us, of some of the outside portions of Guantanamo. You have razor wire. It's in a crazy system to be able to get in. The detention centers, it's not a court. There's a detention center, but the hearings are not held in courthouses. They're held actually in 7 double-wide trailers. And you go into the double-wide trailers, we observed some of the hearings, and it's a kangaroo court. There's no due process. The judge is military. The prosecutors are military. Interestingly enough, as an African-American person, I was very keen to figure out how the Ethiopian diaspora played out there. And of course, one of the first Ethiopian people that I met was a prosecutor for the state who was basically rolling these kids over and over into administrative detention. The second Ethiopian person that I met was a IDF officer who was giving my host a really hard time about the fact that we were standing outside of a Palestinian shop and making all of the settlers really nervous. It was an eye-opening experience. It was deeply troubling, and it just seems to go so deep, it's hard to figure out where you begin to even start.
As you know, Vince, I'm in the West Bank a couple of times a year, and what I've noticed increasingly is that the Israeli government is trying to discourage people like you, what we might call occupation tourists, but folks who are going over there to see and witness what the occupation looks like. The government's trying to discourage that kind of tourism. So you personally experience a level of harassment while you're there. Could you describe what you experienced?
Absolutely. I thought that I was really pissed off and frustrated at the TSA for what they put me through every time I try to get on a plane. And I also thank my lucky stars, but I'm frustrated that I don't have an Arab or a Muslim surname, which in the U.S. makes it much harder. It's like that, but in steroids when going into Israel. I had an easier time getting into Haiti after the earthquake as a human rights lawyer that was looking to hold the Haitian government accountable for what it was doing than I did getting into Israel. So there were a number of us. And the process is once you land in Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, you know, you go to the immigration office and they look at your passport and they say business or pleasure, and you say pleasure. And then for some of the folks in our cohort, some of whom were of Muslim religion and Arab ancestry, they would ask very probing questions about what's your father's name, what's your mother's name, and additional questions about what they're doing, which is very strange if you're just going into the country as a tourist. They also have what we call a racial profiling check, which is that they look at the brown people, myself included, and they subjected us to more questions than they did the white people that were traveling with us. But then on top of that, there's another area in which once they determine that they want to investigate you further, they take you into a separate room. And that interrogation can last from 1 to 6 hours. One of our colleagues, who's a professor at Yale Law School, was interrogated for 3.5 hours just to get into the country. We had not set foot outside of the airport. And one of the things that you can't say is you can't say that I'm a human rights lawyer. You can't say anything like that because it just raises these types of flags.
So how do you answer some of their probing questions?
Well, you have to answer them honestly. You have to understand that they're trying to keep you out and that they're looking for an excuse to keep you out. And that excuse could be you give the wrong answer or you're evasive or they catch you lying. As lawyers, you never want to do any of those three things. So you have to be, you have to be forthright about why you're there. But at the same time, I think just like with most things in life, you don't give people a reason to try to exclude you from something that you want to do and certainly something that you need to see as a human rights person.
We're speaking with Attorney Vincent Warren, who is the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Vince has just returned as part of a delegation along with two of his colleagues from the center from Israel-Palestine. And we're going to talk to him about, well, what can we do next? Vince, what kind of work is the CCR involved in supporting Palestinian rights?
Well, there are a number of things, and one of the key things that happens below the radar, but I think is deeply important, is that we work in solidarity with groups and lawyers that are there on the ground. And so, for example, with respect to some of the human rights framings, we consult with them as they wish about how some of the pleadings and arguments are made in the human rights context, because that's something that we do at CCR and have some expertise in. And I don't want to be remiss, and I want to just let people know that the organizations on the ground are absolutely vibrant, and they are brilliant. And in some ways, they are facing the same challenges or similar challenges to what we're facing in the United States. And so when I heard the lawyers talking about how when they're trying to challenge the creation of settlements, the demolitions of housings, the building of the walls, the moving people out of their lands, when they challenge those things legally, very often they have absolutely no recourse in the courts. Sometimes they do, and when they do, the Knesset, which is the Israeli parliament, will just change the rules on them. So they're facing a lot of the same systemic reactions, legal systemic reactions, in the context of Israel that we're facing in battling the war on terror here in the United States. So I just wanted to say that it's very important from the legal perspective to be able to support those strategies that are happening first and foremost. Secondarily, we've been working in a solidarity context to try to figure out what, as lawyers based in the United States, that we can do with respect to U.S. complicity with the Israeli government and what's happening over there. So amongst the challenges that we have currently is one is a challenge to the Gaza, one of the Gaza flotillas. We have a Freedom of Information Act request with respect to that ship. This was the ship that was attacked by the Israeli government in international waters. People were injured, and one young man who was an American citizen was also killed in that shooting. So we're pushing the U.S. government to explore the questions of accountability there. On an entirely different but related note, we have we're doing a lot of work in the First Amendment arena. So there's Stephen Salida, who's a professor that was hired to be at the University of Illinois, but was then fired for tweeting critically about Israel during the Gaza siege in 2014. So we represented him and were successful in reaching a settlement that certainly addressed some of his needs, and also sent a very strong message to not just that university, but the university system generally in academia. That type of speech that and academic freedom requires, does not permits, but requires at some level, this type of debate, particularly around issues of Israel. Finally, we've partnered up with a wonderful organization called Palestine Legal. It's headed by my friend Dima Khalidi. And we, along with them, are representing a range of students on college campuses around the country, along with the National Lawyers Guild, to ensure that their protest against Israeli policies, their protest of Israeli speakers coming to campus, their pushing for having Palestinian speakers come to campus, doesn't get drowned out by a very strong bias against that kind of discussion in the university context.
You know, you described the occupation as a kind of experience on steroids, but there are so many connections between police surveillance, the security state in Israel, and the kind of work CCR is doing. Domestically, CCR has an important case around Muslim profiling by the NYPD. You've been very involved in the Lawyering for Black Lives movement. Connect some of those dots for us of work we're doing domestically and what you saw in Israel and the West Bank.
The parallels are really chilling, and I think it's one thing to think about them theoretically, and it's another to spend a little bit of time on the ground and see them actually play out. And so one of the underpinnings of the security state is surveillance. Another one is incarceration. And a third one is policing. And all three of them play out in the domestic context as well as in the Palestinian context. With respect to surveillance, there's essentially no one who is an activist, a Palestinian activist in that country who is not under surveillance. Everyone has some profile, some file that gets actualized in terms of raids constantly. One of the places that we went was Beerzit University in Ramallah, where we met some wonderful, wonderful students that are doing this terrific campaign around the right to education. But we found out when the day before we got there that the Israeli government, the Israeli military, had raided the student offices. And so this is so. What I mean by on steroids is that we know, for example, in the U.S. context, that students are being monitored, and we know that the police and very often campus police is deployed to repress them or intimidate them. The steroidal factor in Israel is that the military actually goes to the university almost constantly. I didn't know that at the time, and just disrupts any type of organizing that's happening. With respect to policing, we are in this strange situation where we know that Palestinians are profiled, I think, so deeply that it's in the U.S. context, we tend to think of racial profiling as a sort of an added level of badness to the way that things normally work. So it's, we know that people discriminate against black folks in the U.S., and we see policing as a way of enforcing that discrimination. And in some ways, that's true in Palestine as well, but it is much deeper than that. The way that Palestinians are policed, both by the military and by the police, is one in which the desired goal is actually not related to criminality at all. It's related to intimidation and repression. It is as clear as day. And that's something that activists here in the United States are beginning to draw parallels to. I'm looking down the road at the U.S., and what I see is the way that the Israelis treat the Palestinians.
Vince, there's a connection that I want you to comment on, and that's the connection between the Israeli police forces training American police forces, as you know, particularly in Chicago. And I wanted your reaction to that phenomena.
There's a globalized industry around police repression that we're seeing, and sometimes the United States exporting practices to other parts in the world. So Ray Kelly, before the Center for Constitutional Rights really stuck it to him by destroying his stop and frisk programs, had a cottage industry of going around the country and around the world rather, and training police on New York City style police practices. It's also important to note there's a sense in which I suspect that the security apparatus in the United States looks at Israel and says, "Gosh, they do it so much better than we do." There's no National Lawyers Guild. There's no Center for Constitutional Rights gumming up the work over there. How do they do that? And the practices are super efficient. They are dastardly, and they are they've managed, in at least in the framing of policing and the militarism there, they've managed to disassociate their police practices from criminality. And they have associated them with a sort of a larger sense of terrorism and the right to exist. So we have a strange phenomenon where I think the Israeli military and policing can teach the U.S. police departments is don't worry about rights. Don't worry about Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter pale in comparison to the rights of white people to exist in the peace that they want to exist in. That's where that's going. And I think the methodologies that they're starting to train and import really are going to essentially destabilize some of the core frames about rights and about human dignity that we are grappling with and trying to hold on to in this country, which in Israel seem to have really fallen by the wayside. They don't seem to matter.
Vince, we only have a minute or two left. Any parting thoughts about your experience and what our listeners can...
Yeah. What are you going to learn do now that you're back on American soil?
I have to say, it's great to be on this program with you all who've been in my situation many times, and it feels very comforting to know that I'm still wrestling with what I just saw and what I'm going to do about it. I've been to South Africa several times, but I was never able to go during apartheid. I can only imagine that had I been able to do that I would have come back being more motivated to shift my role, to shift my government's role, and to inform people about what is actually going on. And I did a fair amount of that even as a college student, not having been there. But this time, I texted a friend of mine. His name is Ahmed Abu Znaid, and he's a Palestinian-American. He's based in Miami. He's one of the leaders of Dream Defenders, which is a wonderful organization. And what I texted him was, I said, you know, Ahmed, you told me what was going on, and I thought I knew. I thought I understood. I went there, and I realized that what I saw is not really understandable. And so that's where I am in my thinking right now. I would urge people to connect with all of the groups that are doing solidarity work here in the United States. Learn as much as you can. There are a number of great organizations and resources to be able to do this. But don't also do it from a perspective of just pure learning. Do it from a perspective of engagement. And I would also say that I would really ask people to engage that question in their homes, on Facebook. I mean, all of us know that if you post something about Palestine on your Facebook page, you're going to get a bazillion hits with people that tell you what you don't understand. You do understand. You know, all you need to know is that there are human beings that are in Palestine who are absolutely being trampled by this regime, and no amount of civility in discourse is going to change that. It's only going to be about action.
If people want to plug into the CCR, I know that you've revamped the communications department and you have a website that's quite wonderful. People, get your pens or pencils, because Vince is going to give you the website.
Yes, if you have pens or pencils, you can also pull out your phone. Our website is ccrjustice.org. That's ccrjustice, one word, .org. And on that website, you can sign up for our email alerts, and that will give you inside information as to what we're doing on a whole range of issues, including our Palestine solidarity work, our work involving torture and accountability, stop and frisk, Black Lives Matter, solitary confinement, you name it. So I hope that you do take that opportunity to learn a little bit more about what we're doing and help us do it.
Vince Warren, always a pleasure to have you.
Vince, we're going to have you back because next year is the 50th anniversary of the CCR, and we want to go over some of the accomplishments of the CCR, especially in recent times. So we'll keep that seat warm for you.
Thanks so much, Vince. Great to see you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Vince.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota, is retired Judge Advocate General Corps Defense Attorney Todd Pierce. Attorney Pierce served in the military for 22 years. We speak with him today about American militarism and the concept held by many, including President Barack Obama, of American exceptionalism. We'll look into the extent to which the United States Constitution has been lost to military rule. Attorney Pierce believes that the rule of law in the U.S. has degenerated, and that there is continuity between law in fascist Germany in the 30s and 40s and the neocons of today.
Attorney Todd Pierce, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure, Todd. We don't often get to speak with people with your background, your military background. You were an attorney in the Army, and you were there for quite some time. And I wanted to ask you about why you went into the Army and what it was like and how that caused your change in thought, if any, and where you've come out at present.
Well, just very quickly, I guess I'd consider myself, when I was younger, and a Cold War liberal, sort of inspired by John Kennedy. I'm that old. So when I was in high school, even though the Vietnam War was going on and I was reading materials critical of it, I sort of was conflicted and had this sense, and maybe going back to my father who'd been in the Bataan Death March, the idea that, well, even if you don't agree with all the policies, you still have to be available as a citizen soldier to do your part as an American citizen. So I didn't actually enlist in the Marine Corps my senior year in high school, knowing where that would lead. That was in 1969, and I failed my physical from a back injury. And so 2 years later, though, I went in the Marine Reserve, having turned more against the Vietnam War, but it was coming to an end, but still feeling that as a citizen, I needed to do my part. That's what began my military experience, career, which never intended to be a career, but as it turned out, I went on and off active duty as a reservist, both in the Army, after I later left the Marine Reserve. I had left the reserves, but had become interested in computer programming, that's what got me back in the Army in 1981. And that led to a full-time job on active duty for about 10 years. Went to the Gulf War, got out, went to the law school, having lost interest in computers for the most part, went to law school, and that became a position as a judge advocate in the Army Reserve. But again, I went on active duty for 5 years, got off active duty, stayed as a reservist, waiting to volunteer to be a military commissions defense attorney because by then, about 2003, I knew there'd be military commissions at some point. And I saw what a violation of the rule of law that was. So I was hoping that I might be able to contribute in some way to trying to restore that rule of law.
So in what ways would you say that the rule of law seemed violated in those commissions?
Well, in so many different ways. You know, initially when we went into Afghanistan, I think it was General Frank that said we need to have Article 5 hearings for the people we've captured. The Bush administration, Cheney, said no, they're all unlawful enemy combatants. They don't get trials. They don't get Article 5 hearings. We can violate Geneva, et cetera, making the argument that the president, as the commander-in-chief, was above the law, was above international law, constitutional law. And so immediately they began not degrading even, but destroying the rule of law. There's a book that came out just this past year by Jens David Olin, who is a law professor. The title, I believe, is The Assault on International Law. And he's one of the few law professors who's recognized what has really taken place. Others have, but not as deep of an understanding as Olin presents.
You know, I remember my first day of law school, Michael Reisman, who was a human rights scholar at Yale, gave us a talk about how human rights law applies to other countries, but not to us. When you're the hegemon, you don't have to follow the rule of law unless it's convenient. Is that what you saw? I found that very disillusioning on the first day of law school, I have to say.
But accurate.
Yeah, I find it disillusioning to have you tell me about it now, that anybody would be so forthright in proclaiming that, although we're used to it by now with John Yoo and you know, a number of so-called progressive attorneys as well.
That leads me to a question, and that is of American exceptionalism, what Catherine just articulated. And it's something that President Obama says he believes in to his very core. What is American exceptionalism?
Well, you know, I think the original narrative, the myth, goes back to John Winthrop with the idea that we're a city upon a hill for the rest of the world to look upon and to aspire to our mode of government. You know, Winthrop, of course, is not a Democrat. I was just looking up the quote, actually, and you know, he's very anti-democracy as well. So it's ironic that we would be using, you know, looking upon that quote as a symbol for us. But, you know, it's relatively benign, I think, through most of our history. My recollection is, though, that we changed the meaning, really, with 2001, you know, 9/11, where the neoconservatives and people like Obama, you know, so-called progressive, subtly shifted the meaning to make it to mean something else than this just benign idea that we should be looked up to by other nations because of our political system, into something that we are, in fact, the exceptional nation, that we're above the law. We don't, you know, as was just said, you know, with Reisner, we are the hegemon and we are above the law. We are the exception to the law. And the exception is a term frequently used in people who are promoting a idea of the state of exception, going back to Carl Schmitt and others, as means to get outside the rule of law, whether the Weimar Constitution or whether our Constitution today.
Can you trace the ideology of current neocons, the ones that led the way in involving the United States in all these wars in the Middle East? Can you trace their ideology back to the Weimar Republic? They had the most democratic constitution in the world, and it was overthrown by Hitler. And do these neocons have any roots in that kind of thought?
They do, and the connection is Leo Strauss, and from Leo Strauss to Carl Schmitt. Carl Schmitt was the Nazi legal jurist. You know, I think he proclaimed the Crown Prince was a term used, Hitler's Crown Prince of Law, or something such as that. Where I began tracking this was with a couple of references to Carl Schmitt back in the early 2000s by Adrian Vermeil and Eric Posner, Posner out of University of Chicago, Vermeil out of Harvard, both very prominent, well-regarded law professors. But in numerous books they've written, they state that we have to go back and study the works of Carl Schmitt for basically the state of emergency democracy that we're now in with 9/11, which is incredibly fascistic. And what's most remarkable is that instead of being roundly condemned by their peers in the law schools and others, you know, they're still looked upon, and there's, you know, Vermeil is working with Cass Sunstein on developing information programs for the Obama administration. I saw a reference to recently. But they make no secret in various books they've written and law review articles that, you know, the president, U.S. president, is also the commander-in-chief, and therefore, using the argument that John, you had used, that the commander-in-chief clause gives the president dictatorial powers, you know, whatever the president says stands as law. And this argument has even been used by, you know, not, I shouldn't say even, is used to this day by the Department of Justice, for example, in the Hedges v. Obama lawsuit.
That's Chris Hedges, the journalist who we've had on our program, and he brought a lawsuit. Talk about that, please, Todd.
So they brought Hedges and a couple of activists, including somebody with WikiLeaks, I believe, and the Icelandic parliamentarian, brought a suit for injunctive relief against enforcement of Section 1021. Section 1021 was passed under the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, and it provides that someone deemed a terrorist or suspected of a terrorist can or should be, will be, put into military detention pending disposition under the law of war. Now, the law of war is a misnomer. It suggests that there's a parallel body of law that provides some restraints on the government, when in fact, and as Olin writes in his book, Assault on International Law, it's very permissive. And that, too, was pointed out in the most recent Law of War manual by the Department of Defense. A law of war is permissive. What it allows is a belligerent in a war to take any action they believe necessary against external enemies, but also against internal enemies, or what they would call internal enemies. It's provided for in part in the Fourth Geneva Convention, where it describes, I think it's Article 5, that a belligerent can protect itself against its own internal enemies and from their hostile acts. The misunderstanding comes from, I think, a lot of people and human rights attorneys to take that term hostile act to mean, you know, somebody using guns against the state or against an army or something, when in fact a hostile act can be just writing graffiti on a wall, say, in the West Bank. And if you look at occupation law as applied in the West Bank and previously in Gaza, now not applied directly but more externally, is that, again, you look at the military commissions and military courts under occupation law in Israel, occupied territory, and they're finding kids who've done nothing more than write graffiti on a wall to have committed a hostile act and putting them into military detention. So Section 1021, when you look at it objectively in light of its predecessors and precedents, provides the authority for the government to even see somebody like Chris Hedges. And I think the term they used in that case by the DOJ was for their expressive acts, meaning something they might write or street theater or whatever, could be deemed a hostile act in supporting terrorism, aiding and supporting the terrorists, for example, and be put into military detention, pending disposition under the law of war, which could mean anything, permanent detention, indefinite detention, military commission, trial before military commission, you know, so we don't know. And I think with the Hedges v. Obama lawsuit, what that could mean was articulated by the DOJ attorney to mean that, yeah, maybe Hedges hasn't crossed the line at this point, but, you know, we don't know where that line is, and a future president might move that line, and so we're all at risk. Anybody who may take a critical position, critical view of a current government policy could be at risk of being put into military detention.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Carl Schmitt's work and that there are conservative members of the Academy that rely on his work as a way to justify this state of exception or kind of lawlessness by the government. But progressive law professors and other scholars also turn to his work as a way to say, actually, the state of exception merely illuminates what's always the case about state power, that it stands above the law, and we just see it more clearly in moments of emergency, that the public is willing to surrender their civil liberties, willing to sort of bracket rights to free speech or political expression. Is that your sense, that we're living in an exceptional time that is a departure from the rule of law? Or are we actually just seeing how power works, and that when it wants to follow the law, if it's convenient to do so, it will, but when it doesn't want to, it won't?
Well, I think Vietnam is a good example. We were in a war, a genuine hot war. We never applied speech suppression, censorship, anything such as that. We did through the COINTELPRO by the FBI clandestinely, and you know, the Army and the CIA were all involved with these things. But again, we didn't come out. We pretended, at least, that we were still applying the Constitution. And in fact, we were, as Dan Ellsberg could show, I think, in part, although his case wasn't settled on strictly that ground. But we still had some actual constitutional rights remaining. Coming out of that war, and I think this is critical in understanding what the military is doing now, you had generals like Westmoreland and Davidson write books afterward, Admiral Sharp, all of whom were involved with the failed policy in the war of attrition, et cetera, that was causing us to go bankrupt, you could say, and besides losing the Vietnam War. They all come out afterward, though, and said, basically echoing Ludendorff from the First World War, German general, we were stabbed in the back. And who they accused that of was the media and the anti-war activists, the dissidents. And this was really a gain favor within the military. A number of books, in addition, were added to this to bolster the argument. A Colonel Harry Summers wrote a book mimicking Clausewitz and using that argument, although avoiding that phrase, but pointing out that, yeah, we lost our will. And that's fundamental to war, the idea that it goes back to Clausewitz. Our will is ultimately determine the outcome of the war. So you have to protect your will. That means suppressing dissent, suppressing speech. Vermeil and Posner actually come out and say, we may have to have censorship because people might say something that would harm the morale of the military. This is the same argument that was made in Germany in World War II and before it, with the People's Court, where people like Sophie Scholl, for example, who should be a genuine hero to anyone who believes in free speech and democracy, all she was doing and her brothers and a couple of others were distributing leaflets pointing out that Germany was losing at Stalingrad and it's time to change the policy. And they literally lost their heads following a conviction of the People's Court. That same idea is what came out of the Vietnam War, and I could go on longer, but I've written a couple articles about it, on how coming out of the Vietnam War, these generals argued, next war we have to have censorship, we have to have information control, all these things that we're now seeing with various processes like embedded journalists, and again, talk like Vermeil and Posner about having the need for censorship. Now we have Cass Sunstein, a prominent progressive attorney, involved with... and has been writing various things about how we need to infiltrate, the government needs to infiltrate websites and whatnot, accusing them of conspiracy theories, and even acknowledging that some so-called conspiracy theories were true, like COINTELPRO when people talk of it. But the truth of it is irrelevant, evidently. Instead, the government has to infiltrate these and change the narrative. In other words, information control. And as you guys no doubt know, I read MondaWeiss.net and Max Blumenthal, the Israeli government is using the same tactics to control the message, seeing the message as, the most important thing in a war versus, even more important than perhaps military victory. So that's where we're at today. We have lawyers, prominent lawyers, claiming that we're in a state of exception when, in fact, previous wars, we never took the steps that we're now doing in what the Army used to consider something other than war, counterterrorism.
Well, I think where the state or the police or the government more generally, and even the judiciary collaborates in this, but is able to create a sense of fear in the people, they will tolerate the suspension of all sorts of civil liberties and fundamental human rights. It certainly has worked in Israel, and I think we see it increasingly in the U.S., and your writing has certainly illustrated that.
It worked in Germany, Catherine, remember?
Absolutely.
The Reichstag fire, mm-hmm. and Hitler overthrew this extremely democratic constitution and said, I have the right to make the law as the executive.
Absolutely. And that came, again, that was an idea. He assumed, presumably would have come to that same idea. He was a dictator, wanted to be one, but Carl Schmitt gave him the intellectual legitimacy and credibility for making such a statement. Schmitt was writing in the 1920s of the need for an absolute ruler over a country. Let me throw out just very quickly a couple of quotes I think are very important. And one is by Judge Prettyman, who the federal court building is named after in Washington, D.C., but he's been quoted, and he wrote, "In raising the specter of horrible hypotheticals, we are reminded of Judge Prettyman's," this from another case, "we are reminded of Judge Prettyman's comments for this court in a Fourth Amendment context. We are dealing with doctrines and not with a presumable taste and sense of individual officials. Maybe none of these examples would ever occur, but the question before us is not whether they would happen, but whether they legally could." And I think that, you know, people quickly say, well, we're not the Nazis. And that's well true, and certainly I'm not finding a moral equivalency. But the model that we're following, legal model, in adopting things such as Section 1021, the Patriot Act, we're following that same template. And we're also following the same template, and the, you know, National Socialists are the ones who created it. How to overthrow a democratic regime in a nonviolent way by using legal measures, such as the Declaration of 1933, the Reichstag Act. But the other thing I want to mention is a quote by a book that I consider extremely important. It's by Ernst Brockel, who was a prominent German Jewish lawyer in the 1930s and the 20s, and sort of, you could say, the ideological opponent of Carl Schmitt. He wrote a book in The Dual State, published in, I think, 1941, but written during the 1930s before he left Germany. And the first line of that book is, "Martial law provides the constitution of the Third Reich." And what that means is, with the, you know, the Reichstag decree, you know, the Constitution, you know, was subsumed by the dictatorial powers of the Führer, you know, the leader. And this is the same argument being made in various ways. I just came back from Hawaii, where I went and visited the Hanauli-Uli internment camp, concentration camp, it was called back then, where we put Japanese Americans into internment that the military had presumed might be dangerous. They were leaders in the community. Now, this all turned out to be a fallacy. And furthermore, it wasn't driven by war hysteria, but rather had been planned going back to at least 1935, including by FDR. But there in Chicago, they declared martial law. It was unequivocally martial law, and it was military rule, as the Supreme Court later called it, and very despotic in various ways, including this internment. On the West Coast, with the Japanese Americans, martial law was not declared, but in fact, if you look at the commentators of martial law, it's not necessary to declare it. In fact, you know, it was actually operated as martial law, and the fact that the military was given control over a large share of the civilian population, the Japanese Americans, for removal. So you could say we had an undeclared martial law at the time. When we have things like the military needs to suppress dissent and all these things, we're talking about a version of martial law. We just haven't declared it. We need to recognize that, and so I think Ernst Brockel is very appropriate for looking at today, for studying where we're at today, and as a counter-narrative to Carl Schmitt.
Right. I think you're absolutely right, and we're running a little short on time, so just one last question, which is, if every government, every state has a will to rule without accountability, I think that's part of what comes with power, whether it's the Obama administration or the Nazis, not, as you say, to say that they're the same or an equivalence, what kind of legal measures do you think can be most effective in rendering states accountable and keeping them in check?
Well, again, keeping in mind that you know, the United States history isn't unblemished, what is very important today is that the military commission's prosecutors are now calling what happened during martial law and the Civil War as our domestic common law war, meaning it's a valid precedent for today for things like Section 1021, disposition under the law of war. But what we've always been protected by, as well as possible, is a Constitution. After the Civil War in Milligan, the Supreme Court condemned the military rule that had taken place. After the World War II and the internment of martial law in Hawaii, the case Kahanamoku roundly rejected the idea that there should be military rule under that situation. Of course, Hawaii wasn't a unique situation. They're basically an aircraft carrier out in the Pacific for the use of the United States. So they were under threat for, let's say, the first year of the World War II. But that, you know, receded very quickly. But yet the military demanded that they continue martial law right up until the end of 1944, and only then, because finally they were so condemned for it, that they had to let it go. And that's a danger. The military has a one-track mind, you could say, a very narrow perspective, and that is to protect against all contingencies. So to give our governance over to the military is to condemn ourselves to martial law. And here's the influence of Israel. We've looked upon them as our fellow democratic ally, and so we've seen it as reasonable to adopt what they've been practicing there into our own system. But in fact, what they're practicing there is occupation law, in other words, martial law. And so by legitimizing it, by having it seemingly come from our democratic ally, we're introducing it into our own system. We're getting training for our police forces this occupation law practices. And it's leading to the destruction of the rule of law in the United States. I'm not just attributing that to Israel, but to our own neoconservatives or conservative revolutionaries, whatever you want to call them. So we're in a very dangerous position, but what is our answer? Go back to the Constitution and demand that, there's not an exception that overrules the Constitution.
Thank you. We certainly appreciate your coming on Law and Disorder. One last thing before we say goodbye. If people want to follow your work, Todd Pierce, how can they do that?
Well, I and a former CIA officer started a group, and we've just been in the process of renaming it, Project for the Study of American Militarism. Sort of a takeoff on PNAC, Kagan's pro-war group. It's a fledgling group. Haven't even got a website up, but hopefully in 2016 we'll get more active with it. When we do, maybe we can pass that information on to you. But I do write a little bit for Consortium News and Antiwar.com and MondoWeiss.net. Let me just say one final word. I think it's critical that Americans begin paying attention to the underlying legal arguments being made and realize where they're coming from. And, when Ernst Brockle wrote The Dual State, he was analyzing what had become, what had been a constitutional democracy of Germany and how it had evolved into a totalitarian dictatorship. And we may never evolve into a totalitarian dictatorship, but we are evolving into an authoritarian, and I think it's not time to use the phrase proto-fascism. If you look at fascism, what it is, militarism doesn't quite seem to capture what we're evolving into. And, proto-fascism means we're on the way. And all you have to do is listen to Donald Trump, any of the Republican candidates, Hillary Clinton I would include in that, to realize that we are becoming the beginning stage of a proto-fascist state, at least, unless we turn things back and turn to the Constitution once again.
Well, thank you for that framing, Todd. That's extremely helpful.
Thanks so much, Todd Pierce, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Yeah.